Today's macroeconomic news brought to you by Section 232 Bravo, subpara 1A of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, investigations by the Secretary of Commerce. Also, the director of the Congressional Budget Office on why the economic facts matter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 20th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is the week of one-word lead stories, I suppose. Yesterday was bonds. Today, it's steel of the imported variety. President Trump has ordered an investigation into whether foreign steel is hurting national security. The aforementioned clause of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 lets the administration impose emergency trade sanctions should it see fit. But in a global economy, one country's national security concerns are another's unjust industry protections, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said the investigation is necessary because steel alloy used in things like armor plating for the military requires specialized expertise. Speaking at a press conference today, Ross said that expertise could be lost if foreign countries continue flooding the U.S. with cheap steel.
You know, we're building up aircraft. We're building up our fleet. We're building more tanks, building all kinds of military equipment.
Steelmakers have long accused China of unfair trade practices. The country makes half the steel in the world. Chad Bown is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says calling out China on security grounds may be a bit over the top.
What I like to refer to is kind of the nuclear option of trade policy. You can't really argue with that if you're a trading partner.
In times of peace, Bown says playing the security card risks escalating a trade tit-for-tat in other markets.
The only thing that you can do is to respond in kind, you know, saying, well, if you're going to do that to me on steel, I'm going to do that to you on your cars or soybeans, whatever it is that the United States actually exports to their market. And that's how these things can spiral out of control.
Bown worries that tariffs could raise the cost of goods farther up the supply chain and perhaps cost other American jobs. Tom Gibson is the CEO of the American Iron and Steel Institute. He says the current situation has already cost 14,000 jobs in the steel industry, and increasing tariffs could turn that around.
There's always been imports of steel into the U.S. market. But if you send steel into the United States, you shouldn't be dumping it, you shouldn't be subsidizing it. And what we're going to insist on is that the steel that comes here be fairly traded.
By law, the steel investigation must be complete within 270 days, but President Trump said he expected the report within 50. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Today in, that's interesting, a story in the Wall Street Journal that says Google plans to introduce an ad-blocking feature on its Chrome web browser. Yes, that Google, the one that makes $1 billion selling those ads. And I know, why would Google want to make it easier for users to avoid them? Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Google's new tool, according to the Journal, would filter out the most annoying ads, pop-ups, and those videos that start blasting automatically, like this one.
Find victory in the massive diversity of war thunder.
Google had no comment today, other than to say it's exploring a multitude of ways to support better ad standards. James McQuivey is a technology analyst at Forrester Research.
Sometimes when there is a consumer movement afoot, you have to go along. And this ad blocking trend is certainly a consumer movement.
At last count, more than 615 million devices around the world were blocking ads, according to PageFair, which helps publishers get around ad blocking software. Johnny Ryan is the company's head of ecosystem. He says Google could end up charging more for the ads that don't get blocked by essentially clearing out a huge portion of the market.
That means that that market will no longer be available for purchase. But whatever else is left available will actually be more valuable.
And as much as we complain about ads, Forrester's James McQuivey says people actually engage with ones from brands they like.
So Google might be quite rational in saying, let's help people get rid of the ads they don't like and therefore put a premium on the ones they do like.
And if it goes ahead with the plan, he says Google gets to look like it's on the customer's side. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up. But look, if traders are buying stocks because the Secretary of the Treasury said today, as he did, the tax reform is going to get done by the end of the year. You need to know that tax reform was also going to get done by March and then by August. So, you know, reality. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. French voters get their shot at turning the established political order on its head this weekend in the first round of their presidential elections. Marine Le Pen, leader of the far-right National Front, has staked her campaign primarily on a hard line on immigration, a very hard line, but also on France, by itself, out of the euro and possibly out of the European Union. From Paris, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the story.
"We are going to win," chant 6,000 ecstatic National Front supporters at a rally in Paris.
"Mesdames, mesdemoiselles, messieurs, chers compatriotes."
The woman they've come to see, Marine Le Pen, a fiery middle-aged Joan of Arc, belting out a familiar message.
"Qui veut dire que la France est nôtre.
France belongs to us," she says. "Our homeland is our responsibility." "On est chez nous," it's our home, a regular National Front refrain. It's both anti-immigration and anti-EU. National Front supporters like Jean Cautereau bitterly resent Europe's passport-free zone. It facilitates the influx of more migrants. Cautereau detests any EU involvement in French domestic affairs.
"I am for Europe, but I am against European dictatorship. We can govern ourselves."
Le Pen says if she wins power, she will immediately pull out of the passport-free zone and renegotiate a much looser relationship with the EU. Then she'll hold a referendum on whether France should leave the single currency and perhaps the bloc as well. Jean-Paul Martin, a retired art gallery manager and National Front supporter, knows already how he would vote.
"You would like France to pull out of the European Union?"
"Absolutely, absolutely. I think we do not take any benefit, actually, from the Europe organization."
That will surprise many Europeans who feel the EU was set up for the benefit of the French. The euro was a French idea. But the scale of French disillusion is apparent in this Parisian market. Many of the shoppers are grumbling about the prices. Daniel Auger, another National Front voter, blames the euro. "With the euro," she says, "our purchasing power has gone down. I feel it, and other French people feel it for sure." A major opinion survey showed the French are less positive about the EU than even the Brits, and the Brits have voted to leave. Karim Amalal, who runs two news websites here, says the French have clearly fallen out of love with Europe.
"In France, people don't believe that the European Union could do anything for solving the problem they have.
Problems like unemployment of 10%. But Amalal, who's pro-EU and anti-National Front, doesn't believe the French will ever vote to leave the Union.
"It's obvious the cost will be huge. So I think when people think about that, they don't think it could be the good solution."
An EU referendum here is unlikely anyway, because according to the polls, Marine Le Pen will not be the next president of France. But this election has so far proved unpredictable. At Le Pen's rally here this week, the crowd sang the national anthem three times. In the middle of her speech. Whether she wins or not, the rising tide of national fervour in this key member state cannot but damage the EU. In Paris, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This has been a relatively low-key week in Washington, politics-wise. Congress has been on recess. The president has been in and out of town. Left behind, though, have been staffers at agencies and offices that do the work that helps the government work. Among them, the Congressional Budget Office and its director, Keith Hall. Hall and the CBO were most recently in the news, you might remember, during the debate and the eventual non-vote on the health care bill. So when we sat down this morning in his office, a very long stone's throw from the Capitol, that's where I started. Congress comes back to town next week. Health care is going to be on the agenda, as you know. What's your state of mind? You dreading them coming back, or is it just another day at the office?
Well, it's kind of another day at the office. You know, we health care is getting a lot of attention right now, but we work on a wide variety of topics.
Yeah.
One of the things I've liked to point out lately is there's all this attention on this one cost estimate on health care.
Yeah.
Last year, we produced 676 cost estimates, and we'll produce that many this year. So it's a lot of topics and a lot of estimates.
Does it make you crazy, though, when you all wind up in the spotlight to the exclusion of all else you do, and it becomes so intensely partisan?
No, we work in a partisan world. We're nonpartisan folks in a partisan world. We're kind of used to that.
Hmm.
Almost everything we produce gets some attention. You Google us any particular day, you'll find some reference to something we've done. One of the biggest challenges always for us is once you do sometimes some pretty sophisticated work, you now have to write it in English. So it can be used. And that's a real challenge.
Well, do you think actually that challenge is part of why you wind up being so politicized, that you have to take what is intensely complicated stuff and make it legible and understandable to lay people and members of Congress and their staffs?
Actually, I think that's a big part of why we've been able to have a pretty strong reputation of credibility and unbiasedness. And we do a lot of talking to experts and getting their views on things and getting them to actually review our analytical reports when we can.
Okay, but wait, aren't you guys the experts?
Well, we are, and we're trying to multiply ourselves in a sense. Yeah. We can't be complete experts in everything. We actually spend quite a lot of time talking to experts and talking to agencies and talking to state governments and et cetera.
You've been around as a government economist for a lot of years. I mean, a lot of years. You don't go back to the beginning of the CBO, but you were in town probably when it was started.
Yes.
Do you think it is fulfilling its mandate today?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I remind myself a little bit is we have this really important role, and we get a lot of focus as if we're sort of constraining Congress.
Yeah.
Well, we are what Congress wants us to be. Congress created us 40 years ago to be independent, objective, and nonpartisan, and we're still that way today because that's what they want.
Do you think Congress actually wants that? Because you can't turn around without the CBO getting beat up by members of Congress.
That's okay. I mean, we get support from the right people. When I get pressure, I don't get pressure over what we've done. I get pressure over, can you guys hurry it up?
Oh, is that right?
We need a vote. You know, they work at a different pace than we do sometimes. We, in this latest healthcare thing, we held things up because it takes a while for our due diligence.
Yeah.
And that's what we get pressure on, really, is the timing of stuff, not that we don't do it right.
Do you ever get the feeling that you're kind of shouting into a hurricane, that there's so much going on out there that the predictions and the reports you guys do get lost until something becomes the political thing of the day?
There might be an element of that. This is one of the things I worry about with staff who've been here a long time.
Yeah.
Is they can work sometimes very, very hard. It can be something like healthcare. We had our healthcare team working day and night through weekends, and we want them to feel like they're having an impact and they're not just, as you say, shouting into a hurricane.
Well, you have to admit you guys had an impact in the healthcare debate. I mean, when you came out and that number was 24 million people without insurance, everybody just went, oh, well, this bill's done.
Well, that may or may not be true. It's something that
he says, very politically aware.
well, it's something they have to live with. If it's something that they want to do, they should be aware of what the likely impact will be, and they should be able to accept that.
We should say that you're a Republican. You are a conservative economist. You have been for your entire life here. How do you keep this organization going down the middle of the road?
Well, we understand our role. We understand our role is to be nonpartisan and to be objective. I've been in that kind of role before. I headed the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You don't want the economic data to be partisan.
Well, no, you don't. But since you brought it up, let me ask you what you think of the President of the United States and his thoughts during the campaign about BLS and how the numbers are fake and all of the politicization that he did to an organization you used to run.
People can use your data and say whatever they want about it. The best you can do is make sure they or try to make sure that they understand the reality of it, how it really works, what it really says. So that's what you hope for. You can't control how people use your data, use your analysis.
So if you had your druthers, bearing in mind that you've been a senior-level government economist for a very long time now, is there a way to get nonpartisan economic analysis more broadly accepted? Or is it just a fact of life that what comes out of this office is going to get batted around by Congress to political ends?
I hope so. You know, there's an element of branding, right? We want to keep our reputation very strong. We want to be credible. If we don't have a good reputation,
it's all you got, right?
It's all we got. We're not valuable to them. Some people sometimes just don't believe the data.
Mm-hmm.
I do get worried that the average American doesn't know what to believe anymore. And that's a problem. And so that's where I think the branding and the reputation winds up being so important.
Keith Hall, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up.
Maybe if we start putting money in our own community, people would not be feeling so frustrated and so helpless.
Put your money where your community is. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 174 points today, 0.8%, 20,578. The NASDAQ up 53 points, 0.9%, 5916. The S&P 500 added 17.7%, 2355. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and tax reform and that whole thing that I told you about. We also told you that President Trump has ordered an investigation into whether steel imports are hurting national security. Well, he was surrounded at the signing by beaming steel executives. Here with the reason U.S. Steel up 7.3% today. AK Steel up 8.5%. Nucor up 4.7%. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.23%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. While the new leadership at the Environmental Protection Agency and elsewhere in the Trump administration has made it clear that there's little appetite for taking on climate change, there are states that are trying to do what they can about greenhouse gases and other pollutants. California has what's called a cap-and-trade program designed to reduce those emissions. The thing is that most factories and power plants that generate carbon pollution also spew a whole lot of other stuff into the atmosphere that has a more immediate health impact on the folks who live nearby. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains there is a new bill in California that will use cap and trade to keep those other pollutants in check as well.
Consider the oil refinery. It turns crude into gas for your car and in the process emits greenhouse gases, a lot of them. California has a cap and trade program that lets an oil refinery process more crude and release more carbon as long as it can trade for or buy enough allowances to cover the increase. That reduces global emissions, but refineries don't just emit carbon. They also spew other pollutants that can cause heart disease, asthma, cancer. Bill McGavern is policy director for the Coalition for Clean Air. He says people nearby
are constantly having to breathe the dirty air that's released by those refineries.
Those toxic pollutants are regulated locally, but that hasn't been enough, McGavern says.
We still have the worst air pollution in the country here in California. And we know that the people in low-income communities of color are bearing a disproportionate burden for that air pollution.
The new California bill wants to add more regulation at the state level. It would use the cap-and-trade program to do it. Heavy polluters like oil refineries that sit in low-income areas won't be allowed to increase their greenhouse gas emissions and trade them. Jared DeShazo is with UCLA.
This is the first time that the design of a greenhouse gas policy has been manipulated in the service of trying to solve another problem.
He questions the logic of using cap and trade to regulate something it wasn't designed to do. He'd rather see local regulations get stronger. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
The National Bankers Association lists 21 black-owned banks in the United States, just 21. But they are the focus of a new-ish social media campaign, hashtag BankBlack, a call for people to move their money to banks that are black-owned or have traditionally served the African-American community. Best guesses are that people have moved more than $60 million so far. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what is driving the movement and what it means for those few dozen black banks left in the United States.
Last July, Terry Williams was out of the office helping her daughter move into a new apartment when she started getting frantic phone calls.
Something is going on. Please come back to the office. We need help.
Williams is the president of Boston-based One United Bank, the largest black-owned bank in the country, with $650 million in assets. And her employees were calling to tell her that people were swarming the bank.
They were coming into the branches. They were lined up outside the branches. They were calling.
The bank had gone from opening about 50 accounts a day to 1,000. The sudden surge of interest stemmed from a call out to the community. Earlier that week, two black men, Philando Castile in Minnesota and Alton Sterling in Louisiana, had been shot and killed by police. Soon after, the rapper Killer Mike appeared on TV and on radio stations like Hot 107.9 in Atlanta, urging people to move their money to black-owned banks like Atlanta's Citizens Trust.
You can go to your bank tomorrow and you can say, until you as a corporation start to speak on our behalf, I want all my money. Right. And I'm taking all my money to Citizens Trust.
This was the birth of the Bank Black movement. Michael Grant, president of the National Bankers Association, a trade group for minority-owned banks, says the movement started because people wanted to do something in the wake of the shootings. The idea was this.
Maybe if we would build up our institutions and specifically our banks, maybe we start putting money in our own community and creating more opportunities and more jobs, people would not be feeling so frustrated and so helpless.
Black banks have been around since after the Civil War. And during the Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King Jr. called upon the black community to transfer money into them. But facing competition and other pressures, the banks have dwindled. In 2001, there were nearly 50. Today, there are only 23, most with fewer than $400 million in assets. The message of the Bank Black movement is that people should invest in these banks, that they serve the black community in ways other banks don't. William Michael Cunningham is an advisor at creativeinvest.com, a research firm focusing on impact investing.
They are more likely to seriously consider financing requests from African Americans than other banks are.
A recent study from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation showed that in 2011, black banks made nearly 67% of their mortgage loans to black borrowers. Community banks that aren't run by minorities made fewer than 1%. Justin Garrett Moore was one of the people inspired by the call to action last summer. He moved his savings to multiple black banks and helped create a group called Bank Black USA. Sitting in front of his computer, he pulls up a Google spreadsheet the group created for its website.
We've compiled for people really a resource of a lot of different factors that they might be looking into.
The spreadsheet lists each bank's location, size, number of ATMs, interest rates, as well as data on the bank's health and what it does with its money.
It could be how much of the money are they actually lending to minority people, how much of their financial services bank branches are located in minority communities.
William Cunningham from creativeinvest.com says for the movement to have the intended effect, consumers will have to hold their banks accountable in this way.
Just moving your money won't do it. You actually have to stay engaged and you have to stay involved with the black bank that is the recipient of your funds.
As for One United, in just the second half of last year, it brought in more than $20 million in deposits. Terry Williams attributes the increase entirely to the Bank Black movement and says that money is allowing the bank to make more loans to the community. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which I think it's time to give millennials a break. It turns out they are not the feckless job hoppers they have been made out to be. New research from Pew, it's their analysis of census data actually, shows that 18 to 35-year-olds stay in their jobs longer than Gen Xers did at the same age. Why they stay isn't so well understood. One factor, Pew says, could be that they are generally better educated than their elders, you know, relatively speaking. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 174 points today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ up 53 points, 0.9%. S&P 500 up 17.7 tenths%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor again and still for now is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back tomorrow in L.A., everybody, if my flight is on time. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.